Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
Yes, well, let's listen to a little Jimmy Little.
I was born on the banks of the Murray. Yorta is my mother's tribal stand. I'm her son, but my father's name I carry. As I walk through this great and ancient land.
Here's the great Jimmy Little singing about the Murray. The Murray is Australia's longest river at 2,508 kilometres. It's fed by several rivers on its journey from the Australian Alps. The main feeders, of course, are the Darling and the Murrumbidgee. Now, we've talked about the Murray-Darling Basin on the show many times, the health of the basin, the buybacks, the Royal Commission. And tonight, we just want to get away from that discussion. Of course, water has politics in Australia. There's no doubt about that. But tonight we want to talk to and about the communities that live along the Murray River, to hear about the stories of the river and to learn about the history of the Murray, from the tales of Indigenous ancestors and how they believe the Murray was created, to the iconic steam paddle boats, and indeed what are the cliffs, the trees, the water birds and the fish, and what do they tell us about life along one of Australia's richest ecosystems. If you live along the Murray, Murray Bridge, Echuca, Mildura, Albury, Renmark, Swan Hill, Wodonga, just to name a few towns, love to hear from you. Give us a call and share your stories of living by the river. Here's a fun fact. The Murray River is the third longest navigable river on the planet. I know. Only the Amazon and Nile rivers are ahead of it. Plus, it provides water to about 1.5 million households, as well as farms and other businesses all along its length. Well, joining us first tonight to talk about life along the Murray River is Peter Phillips. Peter's a teacher. He's paddled the full length of the Murray twice in 2012 and 2016, a kayak journey of 2,400 kilometres from its headwaters to the sea. He's also doing a research project for his PhD, researching the Murray River floods. And shortly, we'll also be joined by Sissy Cooper, a Yorta Yorta woman who lives by the Murray, and we'll also cross to one of the paddle steamers at Perakuta Station to speak with skipper Warren Hardiman, and we'll speak to him live in the program, hopefully, once we get a line through the paddle steamer a little later on. First up, though, to Peter Phillips. Peter, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a terrific pleasure to have you with us, too. You grew up along the Murray. Whereabouts?
In Echuca. So, yep, I grew up. Spent all my younger years here before going off and sort of travelling the world a bit. And to my surprise, I ended up back here. It's a great place to raise a family.
Yeah. All right. Tell us about your memories of growing up there.
Oh, well, the town was a lot smaller. And the river used to flood every October as the snows melted. And that flood, that would define the town. When I was little, when I was about 12, one of the big floods, 10 and 12 actually, we had two big floods, 74 and 76. And they were that big that all the schools closed and we went out, all the kids went out, everyone who had a shovel grabbed one, we all filled sandbags. It was exciting. but it was also dramatic. You know, you were trying to save houses. I was pretty young, so we just got into the drama of it. But our parents, well, they worked hard.
Yeah, I remember my first memory of going to Echuca so many years ago. I remember the wharf at Echuca being miles above the surface of the river. And I was thinking, wow, did that mean that at one time the river was up around the top of the wharf here so people could actually use it? Yes. And that would be part of your memory too, I imagine.
That's right. It still happens. It just doesn't happen every year. It used to happen every year. But now we regulate the river. The water is able to be controlled better. And we've been through some dry years. But it still does flood. In 2016, it got fairly high. in 1992, so already going back a little bit, it was actually right up near the top.
Yeah. Tell me about...
It still happens. It's just rare.
Yeah, all right. Let's get back to the Murray. Tell us about the reasons behind your decision to kayak the length of the river. I mean, well, it seems an extraordinarily long trip. You were struggling a bit yourself at the time, weren't you?
Yes, I was. Well, one of the things, when you live on the river, it's the water is coming from somewhere and it's going somewhere. It's special being on the river and seeing it happen. But at some stage in your life, I think everyone who lives on the river wants to follow that path, follow the river.
Hmm.
It's almost as if you don't somehow connect with that river, you've still got part of yourself that needs to be explored. For me, I was recovering from a chronic illness and really doubting myself, but doubting myself personally, professionally. And I thought that a long trip like this might sort me out, might make me stronger. And it did, but it did so much more. It helped that connection to country, gave me a connection to country, which I thought I had, but it was so much greater.
Hmm.
And you know, just also, it's really quite an adventure.
Yeah, I can imagine. Look, as someone who's spent an awful lot of time around the Murray Mouth in South Australia over the years, and the Coorong and Goolwa and those lower lakes there, that's where the Murray comes out, of course. Well, presumably you've been to where it starts. Where's that?
I haven't been up to the foothills. Oh, I've been to Kosciuszko. People say it starts on the slopes of Kosciuszko. There's the closest place is something called Co-Wombat Swamp,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't really sound that intriguing. But it then pretty soon tumbles into the Indi River, which becomes the Upper Murray and flows through Albury. And then it hits the plains. And from there, it's not long until it gets to the giant River Red Gum forests. And it changes from there on. It's a sort of a, I want to say lonely, but at the same time, it's not, because there's so much going on. But I suppose this sense of nature is overwhelming. The power of the river, the power of nature, the awesomeness of nature. And you only see towns every now and then. So you might have 200 kilometres or even 400 kilometres between settlements. So you're out by yourself. You're immersed in nature. It's a fantastic experience.
Mm. So, I mean, I said it's the third longest navigable river in the world, which might surprise some people. But, we're talking about a river that you can actually paddle down as you did. What were you trying to do in 2012 when you did this? I mean, you say you were struggling with Ross River fever. What were you trying to do for yourself?
I was trying to avoid steroids. I was trying to make myself stronger. I was stacking on the weight. I thought that if I just the Ross River fever, the way it worked for me was it just made you chronically tired. You really couldn't do much. I went through about 2 months where I could only walk about 15, 20 steps, and years and years where I still haven't recovered with my walking. But yeah, so it was, the idea was to try and strengthen it. And I had always paddled. I'd always paddled the river. It was something I knew I could do. So I thought I'll play to my strengths and see how I go.
How long did it take you, Peter?
Oh, about 32 days. Yeah.
Okay.
I got stronger and stronger as I went on. You just start off, you just do what you can. And every day you might do a little bit more and, yeah, you just take it as it comes.
Mm. You kayaked once in 2012 and then again in 2016. What was different about those journeys?
Well, the 2012 one was just after the millennium drought. So I was actually quite shocked by the condition of some of the banks and the trees, and it all looked rather vulnerable. And I decided that I would try and find out about that. So, I started the PhD study into the condition of the ecosystems along the river. What happened was, just before I took off, it flooded. And so I ended up kayaking down the entire length of the river near the peak of the biggest flood of recent times.
Mm.
That was amazing.
Yeah, I can imagine. What's it like being that close to the water? You must notice the geography, and you must be intensely aware of the flow of the flow of the river too.
It does all sorts of interesting things in floods. Like there are some sections that go backwards, some areas where it abandons the river and takes off through the bush. But probably one of the most amazing things would be in those red gum forests. There, the banks are fairly low. And, the river sits at the top of those banks. And you realize then that you're actually higher than the forest itself, because the floodplains actually slope away from the river.
They slope away from the river banks, don't you? So in a strange sort of way, the river sits higher than the landscape it's in.
Exactly. So even though I'd spent all my life on the river, that did not sink in until I was paddling down just 2016. Mm. Quite amazing.
Yeah, it's a... you must have favourite sections of it. There are quiet corners, of course. What's a favourite section of it for you?
Well, I actually like the area. I mean, there's so many beautiful bits. The Upper Murray is beautiful. The water is so clear that when you look down, you can see the fish swimming amongst the water plants. It's almost as if they're flying and you're perched above them, like in the clouds. The red gum forests are wonderful for the flocks of cockatoos that fly along the river ahead of you. The Mallee area has rolling red sand dunes that come down to the river. And down in the gorge area, there are 30-metre high cliffs, limestone cliffs, which when you pedal along underneath them, the water echoes off the hollows within those cliffs. It's hard to say which one is special. I think I'd like to go back to the cliffs and spend more time there.
Did you go all the way through the barrage at Goolwa and right to the mouth of the Murray?
I did on the second time, yes. I was joined by seal there, actually. Kind of nice.
Yeah. How would you rate the health of the river at the moment?
Ah, that's an interesting one. Us Aussies, we talk down what we've got. We talk down what we do.
Yeah.
You mentioned it being, the longest navigable river. Not longest, one of the longest.
The third longest navigable
third
river.
Third longest. But it's there are some other things that can claim fame to. And they've got to do with our country. It's a entire river system, an entire basin that exists in one country. And that means that we look after it as an entire system. So many rivers around the world are crossed between countries. And if we think our states argue about the rivers, wait till you see what the countries do.
Mm.
Yeah, so they start wars over them. and we might seem like that sometimes. But so... getting back to your question, what kind of state is it in? It could always be better, and I suppose we are always trying to make it better. We're also trying not to lose what we've got. But it's actually a river which is, despite the flow being regulated, it's essentially wild. Its banks are natural banks, whether they're eroding or depositing or trees falling in, they're natural. This is an enormous thing. The rivers of Europe are mostly within walls to aid navigation. They are starting to rewild them. The rivers of the USA, Mississippi as well, it used to be a wandering river, but it's been channeled. The Colorado, which flows down towards Mexico, in 10 kilometers before the Mexican border, they divert 90% of the flow across to California. And it's so regulated that if you want to take a rafting trip down the Grand Canyon, they turn the water on for you.
I'm talking with Peter Phillips. He's a researcher and teacher and kayaked the Murray River twice. We're talking about the Murray. Peter, every time, of course, you enter a town along the Murray, you're entering a place that's steeped in Aboriginal history and stories and spiritualities. This is a little clip, of course, which is about how the Murray River was made. A Dreamtime Bangarang story.
How the Murray River was made. Or in my language, I say Dungala or Dungala. I'm going to tell you a Bangarang story about how the Murray River was made. One day, an old woman was walking with her three dingoes. She was looking for grubs and berries. She walked a long way over hills and mountains, through forests and bushland, and across a flat and waterless plain. Do you know what she did? As she walked, she dragged her digging stick behind her. The stick dragged and scratched, dragged and scratched, making a track along the ground. Nearby, there was a snake, a big snake of many colours, sleeping in the hills. The sound of the digging stick woke this big snake, and he had come down the hills slithering and sliding. He was very angry. He thrashed to and fro, deepening the track made by the old woman. His movements carved out a wide riverbed, and soon after, it rained and rained and rained some more, creating a river that was long, deep and wide. And that is how the Murray River was made, stretching all the way to the sea. Listen to the sound of the sea, and you may hear the voice of the old woman as she sings in her sleep.
Yes, How the Murray River was Made, a Dreamtime Bangarang story, narrated by Najik Day Burns and Lockie Somerville. I'd like to bring in now Sissy Cooper. Sissy's a Yorta Yorta woman who lives along the Murray in Echuca. Sissy, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. You're a direct descendant, I learn, of William Cooper, the great Australian Aboriginal political leader.
Yes.
And activist.
He was my great uncle.
Yeah. Oh well, that's a very proud history that you have. Tell us about you do a number of dances for some of the steamers on the river, etc. Tell us about your inspiration for those dances, Sissy.
My inspiration comes from my elders, and I've danced now for 15 years and have taught a lot of children how to dance as well. We do a few dances, and one dance I'm actually working on at the moment is a water appreciation dance.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be shown to the community of Echuca.
Okay. Tell me what the dance, what does the dance say? What's the story behind the dance?
It's a story about appreciating the water runs that we do have here in town and showing appreciation to it being our biggest provider as Yorta Yorta people.
Yeah, and you get inspiration from your ancestors in telling that story, do you?
Yes, inspiration from my ancestor and my elders as well.
Yeah, the Murray has got a huge, rich history, hasn't it? Stretching, 40,000 years or more back. Yep. Some of the elders you know talk about growing up on the Murray. Tell me about some of the stories they tell.
There's a few stories. My mum used to speak about how they would run off Cummeragunga Mission and swim the river away from the government, and they would swim to the other side to hide.
Okay, it sounds like a frightening story. Actually, because they're trying to hide from. So they'd hide what down the banks of the Murray, would they?
Yeah. And there's a lot of stories my mum's told me about living in tin shacks along the riverbank and growing up fishing with her mum and her dad. And playing by the river.
What does it mean to you personally? I mean, you live in Echuca, Sissy. What does it mean, the Murray, mean to you personally?
It's a life source, I guess, for me. Like, I've always seen the river as a big, a big appreciation for it, for what it does provide us.
Do you feel the stories of the river when you walk along it?
Yeah, I do. I do feel a lot of the stories that have been passed on to me from people. And I do love walking by the river and spending time by the river. It's a calming place.
Yeah. Do you have a favourite part of it yourself in Echuca?
There's a beach that we have. We call it a Moama Beach, but we go down there a lot and spend time by the river and have swims and plays and, it's a iconic spot of the town.
Yeah, it's just such a rich thing, isn't it, to feel, you must feel this, that to think people have lived on this river for tens and tens of thousands of years. And when you walk along it, do you feel that past as well?
I do. I feel like my ancestors are there with me, and it is a place I go to gather my thoughts and do a bit of meditation along the river to strengthen myself and my spirit.
Yeah, yeah. The Murray is a place not just of stories, but also as a place of, as you say, of that sustained people, Sissy.
Yep.
Do you still have that sense of it today?
It does sustain a lot of people. I do believe that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. You'll do your, it sounds as though you're doing your best to keep those stories alive and to pass them on to future generations as well.
Yes. Pass it on to the kids and do a lot of work within schools and kindergartens around traditional dancing and growing up on the river and try and tell my story as much as possible.
When you're talking to people, you know, on steamers and other visitors to the river, do you think they appreciate that this is more than just, you know, a waterway? It's also a life source?
Yeah, I do believe they appreciate the stories that hear, and it gives them an understanding of why us as a people do rely a lot on the river.
Yeah, yeah, terrific. All right, Sissy, thanks for joining us. It's been terrific to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good on you. Sissy Cooper, Yorta Yorta woman, lives in Echuca.
Nightlife with Philip Clark on ABC Radio.
Yes, Philip Clark with you on ABC Radio. We're talking about the Murray River tonight and what it means and its history, its Indigenous past as well. My guest tonight, Peter Phillips, is a teacher and researcher. He's kayaked the Murray River twice and he's with us. Peter, welcome back again. Nice to speak with Sissy about it. That rich history of Aboriginal occupation of the river, Aboriginal life along the river, is something that it's important to keep alive, isn't it? Did you have a sense of any of that when you were kayaking down the river?
Oh, well, one of the ways you would see that would be the canoe trees. We'd always get excited I would always get excited when I see a canoe tree. I still do, because there is that connection. It's right in front of you. But indirectly, all the the magnificent old River Red Gums, the reeds growing on the banks, the fish. You know, they're all things that sustained people for all those tens of thousands of years. So there is that sense, and in a way, it's like a challenge. A challenge to maintain the river and the areas around it in a way where those things are not lost, where they can be available to the people who come along after us. Hmm. You do get that feeling of being a custodian.
Yeah, that's interesting. As I say, I think a lot of people do feel that about many parts of Australia when you realise, you know, the richness of this ancient land and the people that have gone before. All right, thanks for that too. Let's go to the waters of the Murray right now, because I think we've managed to get him. We have, yes. Warren Hardiman is the skipper of the paddle steamer the Emmy Lou in Echuca, and he's joining us now from Perakuta Station. Warren, good evening and welcome to Nightlife.
Thank you very much, Philip. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, I think it's the first time I've ever spoken to a paddle steam captain here on a river anywhere in the country, on Nightlife at least, Warren. So it's a first.
Not the last,
I hope. I hope not. No. How's your? What's the view right now?
Oh, the view is absolutely fantastic, Philip. I'm sitting up in the wheelhouse at the moment and gazing out at the still waters of the Murray. There's no wind about, so it's a bit like a mill pond, as they would say. So you can see the reflections of the trees and the water, and even some of the stars reflecting off the water as well. And it's just not a lot of night birds at the moment, but certainly you hear the cicadas and whatever else the night creatures singing and calling.
What have you been? Have you been on the water all day?
Yes. Since Monday, actually. We're in the middle of a four-night cruise.
Right.
So we cast off this morning. What time was it? I forget now. But we've been on the river. It's been a long day, so we've been out there all day. Yeah.
So tell me about what you do. Like, I mean, where do you paddle from and to in the Emmy Lou?
So essentially we go from Echuca down to Currumbri Weir and back again. So that's usually a four-night cruise. It's about a distance of 82 kilometres from Echuca to Currumbri Weir. And when there is enough water around, we go through the weir as well, through the lock chamber, I should say, and go a little way downstream. And if we have enough water and enough time, we sometimes go up to Barmer as well, up to the Barmer Lakes and around there as well. So it's a pretty good stretch of the river we go along.
Because when it's full of water, you can, you know, and back in the old days, you used to be able to paddle almost the entire length from South Australia all the way up the Darling, couldn't you?
The paddle boats frequently went from as far downstream as Goolwa, even out to sea, actually. A lot of the boats went around to Port Adelaide in the early days, but they would go from Goolwa more than 2,000 kilometres up the Murray as far as Albury.
Yep.
They travelled up the Murrumbidgee River in New South Wales as far as Gundagai, and they even went up the Darling River as far as the Queensland border.
Yep.
It's the Barwon River up there, and even up the Goulburn River in Victoria as far as Seymour. That's only 103 kilometres from the Melbourne CBD.
Yeah. So it's extraordinary now when you go out to far western New South Wales and think, and you look at the old wharves on the Darling and think, hang on, they used to be paid. You're kidding. But they did, didn't they?
You'd struggle to get a canoe up there these days.
You'd struggle to get, that's right. You'd struggle to get a paper boat up there half the time these days. Yeah.
That's true. But look, it's a bit of a cliche to say that the river and the river system, including the Darling and the Murrumbidgee, was a highway of commerce. But it really was. I mean, it really was. They were the roads, the towns along there. They all were built to face the river. There was not really any road access to those towns at all. If you wanted to go to one of those remote communities, you went by river or you didn't go at all.
Yeah, exactly. How long have you and the Emmy Lou been tooling up and down the Murray?
Well, the Emmy Lou's been operating since the early 1980s. So if you see photos of her, you'll think she dates back to the 1880s, but she's a fairly recent arrival. But she's still steam-powered, so she's an authentic paddle steamer.
Okay, so it's still steam powered. Well, I imagine the whole point about paddle steamers is they have a very shallow draft. Is that it?
That's the intention. Yeah. And they do. They're flat bottomed, which means they do tend to wander around a little bit. So you're always at the helm, just correcting and correcting again and counter correcting. So they are flat bottomed, and and no keel or anything like that. Mm. So they were designed to operate in very shallow water.
Now you're joining us tonight from Parakuta Station. Tell me about Parakuta. It's been on the mighty Murray since the late 1800s. Tell me about it.
Since a bit before that, actually, since the mid 1800s, it was 1847. It was first established by James Maiden, who was an ex-convict. He established a punt crossing over the Murray, and then founded the township of Moama, which incidentally is an Aboriginal word, or derivation of an Aboriginal word, Moami, meaning place of the dead. Mm. But he then founded Parakuta Station. He later fell on hard times, but Parakuta Station flourished. It was later taken over by Cobb & Co. Coaches, actually. Robertson Wagner, who owned Cobb & Co. Coaches, used it to breed their horses and stable their horses and grow hay and crops and things to feed their horses. I can't speak highly enough of Parakuta Station. It's like being in a museum when you walk through it today. It's just terrific.
Yeah, there's another important piece of history. Well, there are so many along the Murray, but tell me about Dead Horse Point. Said to be the place where the last ever bare knuckle boxing bout happened.
So they say. On the 20th of March 1879, a fellow by the name of Larry Foley from Sydney took on his older, more experienced opponent, Abe Hicken from Melbourne. And the police knew about this bout taking place. Bare knuckle boxing, even in 1879, was illegal. So the police were determined to stop it. So they were sent off on a wild goose chase up to Barmer, when in actual fact a fight was taking place downstream of Echuca. And the two men slugged it out at dawn over about 16 brutal, bloody rounds. And finally, Larry Foley was the winner. But it is said that amongst all the backslappers and well-wishers who were congratulating Larry Foley on his win, two tall, bearded young bushmen emerged to offer their congratulations. And it is said that the two men were Ned Kelly and his lieutenant in the Kelly gang, Joe Byrne. And after offering their congratulations, they disappeared into the sunrise and into the pages of infamy, of course. But Larry Foley and Abe Hicken fared a little better, but not much. The police caught up with them and charged them with public affray, and they were ultimately charged and were convicted and fined a considerable amount of money, much more than the purse and much more than any winnings they might have accrued, so it must have made it unprofitable, so it was never done again.
Dear, the ramshackle times of the early years of white settlement. Yeah. White settlement, I tell you. When you're out along, I mean, many outback parts of Australia, there's a sense of the, I don't know, a lot of the follies of the past too. And, you know, people have tried to run sheep when they shouldn't have, you know, the land wasn't up to it. And the abandoned wool sheds and abandoned farm machinery and all of that. Do you get that sense of the Murray when you're travelling along it, that people have tried and failed a lot of the time along the Murray to make a go of things?
I'm not so sure about that. I mean, certainly the mistakes that were made are pretty evident. I mean, as far as the red gum forests, we always make the point you're not going to see too many river red gums along the river more than about 150 years old, because the old ones are all chopped down to build the paddle steamers or to shove into the furnaces or the fireboxes of the steam engines. So they chopped down huge amounts of the forest, and the snags were removed. So they used to clear the fallen trees and branches from the river to maintain a clear navigable channel. And then they wondered why the banks were all eroding and why the native fish stocks were depleting and things like that, because the snags helped to protect the banks, and they also they provide breeding grounds and habitat for the native fish and other native life. So that sort of thing is certainly very, very obvious when you cruise along the river. And I think perhaps up the Darling had more instances of people who just really battled and ultimately never got anything.
No, we're talking about the Great Murray River tonight, and we're joined by a range of people too. I'm currently speaking with Warren Hardiman. He's the skipper of the paddle steamer Emmylou, and he's on the Murray River right now. He's in the wheelhouse. Also with us is Peter Phillips, a teacher and researcher, and he's kayaked the Murray River twice. Peter was saying earlier, Warren, that there are long stretches of the Murray where, because of the nature of the river, and the river banks are higher than the surrounding landscape, and you can often, depending on the water level, get a sense of the river being higher than the land you're flowing through, that it's flowing through, and you get a kind of vantage point. Do you get that from the paddle steamer too?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, actually, you should mention that, because just today I was looking out of the window here and thinking that very thing. Of course, the river is so regulated these days that doesn't flow the way it did naturally. So once upon a time, a lot of those depressions, I suppose, would have been wetlands or floodplains, perhaps, you know, would have been filled up with water for half of the year. That sort of thing doesn't happen so much.
Hmm.
But yeah, that is quite a unique feature, that you look down and, as you mentioned, you can see these depressions on the side of the river, and it is a little bit odd, I suppose, to be honest.
Yeah. If you'd like to join us, by the way, 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. There are lines free. Grab one, 1-300-800-222. If you maybe got questions, or you've had an experience on the river yourself and the Murray yourself you'd like to share, 1-300-800-222, or text me on 046-7922-702. Warren, stay with us. I'd just like to go back to Peter now too, for a second. Peter, what do you think the biggest challenges for the river are environmentally at the moment?
I think it is actually getting water out onto those floodplains.
Yeah.
We tend to think of the forests. It's not just the forest. Behind every meander, which is what we call a bend in the river, there's a miniature floodplain. And they're little hotspots of biodiversity, or at least they're potentially hotspots of biodiversity. Some of those are those depressions that Warren was talking about. If we can get water onto those, we can really give the whole system a bit of a boost. And it could be something that's done in cooperation with farmers. Actually, a lot of farmers do that kind of thing.
Hmm.
One of the things that you find out in our country communities is farmers are amongst your best conservationists. As we were saying before, they feel like they're custodians of the land, and well, they are. And many farming families have been there for generations, and they feel a responsibility to the land. So I think, the biggest challenge is to, with less water, try and do what the river used to do, at least in some places. Sure, we have things like environmental flows and so on, but they're very targeted, and they tend to be political, and they put these flows in what they call icon sites, like the Barmer Forest or the Edwards Wakul system, and often the little places all along miss out. So I think the biggest challenge will be to find that balance, encourage people, help them, provide resources, knowledge, tax breaks, that sort of thing.
Mm. What do you think, Warren? How do you assess the health of the river at the moment? Because often when you talk to, if you're just an occasional consumer of news about the Murray, you'd think it is all bad all of the time. What's your view of the health of the river at the moment?
Yeah, you're right. People do assume that the Murray River is not like the Nile or something like that. So it's always a fairly scraggly river, really.
Yeah, but it always was, wasn't it? That's the thing.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And people come on here, and even if the river's fairly high, people will say, geez, the river's low, isn't it? And it's like, well, not really. But to me, I think perhaps the biggest problem is just the thirsty crops that we grow along the river system. That to me would be the biggest issue. I just can't understand it. And I guess it's a big issue. So you spend a whole night just talking about this. But that to me is when you think about the cotton and the rice. And I know, again, it's a well-worn argument, and there's probably cotton growers and rice growers listening to this, rolling their eyes and saying, not again. But I'm yet to hear convincing arguments as to why we are growing cotton and rice and almonds and things like that along our rivers.
Yes.
And our such thirsty fruits and crops.
Yes, there is a big discussion about all of that, that's for sure. All right, so Warren Hardiman's the skipper of the paddle steamer Emmy Lou. He's on the Murray right now. Peter Phillips with us as well, a teacher, researcher, and he's kayaked the Murray River twice, which is, I would think, a bucket list thing that many people might want to do as well. Do you have to be super fit to do this, Peter, or do you think your average run-of-the-mill kayaker could do it?
Look, anyone can do it.
Yeah.
Absolutely anyone. It's a huge achievement when you do it, don't get me wrong, but you've just got to find the right pace for yourself, find the right boat, and find the right pace. When you get tired, stop. When you're ready, go. You can do it.
You can be in the water the whole way, can you?
You can. You can go through the locks and everything, which is actually quite scary.
Yeah.
you feel very small in those locks.
Yes, I can imagine. I've been through the barrage at Goolwa right at the end, in a big speedboat. But I imagine in a little kayak, it might be quite frightening.
You actually get whirlpools. It's like being a rubber duck in a bath.
I can describe you for a second, Philip, because I'll say to Peter, if you think they seem very big when you go through in a kayak, they seem very, very, very small when you go through in a paddle steamer.
Yeah, I bet you.
Rowan sent me a couple of texts saying, what's a paddle steamer? Well, Warren, it's a flat-bottom boat and it's driven by a paddle. To explain how it works.
Exactly right, yes, a flat-bottom boat. We have side wheelers mainly on the Murray, so two wheels on the side with floats or paddles attached to them. And a machine in the middle of the boat which drives those paddles around. In our case, it's a steam engine.
All right. Why don't we have the big rear wheel paddles like they have on the Mississippi?
Well, as quickly as I can, I think the main reason is because on the Mississippi, the river's very wide, so they used to have their barges lashed alongside or pushed in front of them.
Right.
In Australia, especially on the Murrumbidgee and Darling Rivers, they're very narrow. You have to tow your barges along behind. Now, if you're towing your barge along and you hit a sandbar and your boat comes to a sudden stop and there's nowhere for the barge to maneuver around you and it crashes into the back of your boat, it's smashed up your paddle. You've got no means of propulsion, whereas the side wheelers, the wheels, paddles are protected.
All right, let's take a call or two. Norman is with us. Hi, Norman.
Hi.
Hi, Norman.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm in Perth. I was born in Perth. I'm 78 years of age. And my sister, who did the research, is 85. We believe, or she told me, that it's either my great-grandfather or my great-great-grandfather had the original panel steamer on the Murray.
Oh, yeah.
And there's something in the museum in the town west of Echuca. Whether the whole steamer's there or not in the museum, I honestly don't know. But I just thought it was interesting.
I don't know. Warren, do you know anything about this?
There's going to be a portion of the stem post from the Lady Augusta, which was actually the second paddle steamer on the Murray, built for Francis Cadell, who was a Scottish skipper. And a portion of the stem post is still there in the Historical Society Museum.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay, I think he was a skipper. I'm not sure. But and then at one stage, either him or my great-grandfather was the harbour master in Albany in Western Australia. But anyway, look, I just had to ring because I was interested with the paddle steamer.
Good on you, Norm. Yeah, good on you. Yes, exactly. If you'd like to call, 1-300-800-222 is my number. There are some lines free. Grant from Tassie and Burnie is with us as well. Hi, Grant.
G'day, Phil. How are you going?
Not bad.
Yeah, how are you, fellas, going? Good. I used to work in the late 80s, early 90s on the Murray Princess. That used to accommodate for 100 passengers and 30 crew members. I was just wondering if that's still operational.
Warren?
It certainly is. Yes, in fact, I used to work on it myself about 3 years ago, well, 4 years ago. So, yeah, it's still operating out of Manham in South Australia and still doing great business as far as I as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Okay. No.
Yeah, it was really good. Like, I used to go out from Renmark and up through Berry and through those locks and that. Yeah, it was very, very intrigued by all that. Yeah, it was good memories.
Good on you,
Greg. I used to be a dishwasher on there.
Well, so all the good jobs had gone by the time you arrived, had it, Grant?
Yeah, absolutely. But I had fun doing it. It was great.
Good on you, mate. Thank you. Lovely memories. Lovely memories as well. How does your how does the steam get generated, Warren? Is it wood or coal or what is it?
Yes, absolutely, wood fired. They always were wood fired on the Murray. One or two were oil fired, but never coal. Just because the red gum's so prevalent along the banks of the river, and there was no concern about environmental issues. So yeah, wood fired.
Where do you get your wood from now? I mean, presumably not allowed to go chainsawing the red gums down now, are you?
No, definitely not. No, no. We get out. We've got a contractor who supplies wood for us from around the Barham area.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Trevor. Hello, Trev.
Hello. How are you?
Yeah. Well. Just switch that radio off, Trev. Otherwise, we are.
I'm actually moving out of that area.
That's okay. Yeah. Away you go.
Am I on air now?
You are on air, Trevor. Yeah.
Oh well. In 1969, I did travel down the Murray River from Morgan down to Lake Alexandrina in a canoe with a friend, and it was an amazing experience. But the river was so full and flowing so well.
Yeah.
But over the years that I've been there, I've noticed how it's changed. And to the point where now, if you go down to Lake Alexandrina at certain times, it can be so dry. Because when we actually got down to Lake Alexandrina, it was like 4 foot of waves across it, so we actually couldn't get to the mouth of the...
Yeah, well, it can get very rough on Lake Alexandrina, that's true.
Yeah. It was a beautiful experience. And one of the best ones is when we were actually being blown across the side of a river into the reeds, and one of those paddle steamers came out of the mist, and it was the most beautiful thing you could ever see. And all these people were sitting there in their comfortable little cabins and watching us in the rain, in the mist.
I can imagine.
Blown away.
Yeah, I can imagine. Thanks, Trev. I'll
get off the phone. No worries.
Thanks for joining us. So Julie's texted in from the Blue Mountains saying, Phil, I found the Murray River healing during a bereavement. The ebb and flow and delicious cool air at night was like a balm to the soul. Peter, when you were kayaking down it, where did you stay? It took you about a month, you say. Where did you stay each night? Or did you schedule it for towns, or did you camp on the riverbank? How did it work?
Oh, you can camp on the riverbank. It's the best thing. There's plenty of places. There's beautiful beaches, or you can clamber up the bank and camp amongst the trees. And in a canoe, you can take plenty with you. You know, you can take enough water or food. In the flood trip, though, the water wasn't good. You couldn't drink it. So I had to filter that. Yeah. So it's a friendly river. It's a great river to travel down.
Yes, that's right. You see some of the big rivers of the world, which are turbulent. It's not really turbulent at any point, is it, Peter?
Well, it can get that way. I mean, we get some big winds. If you've got a 50k/h wind blowing for most of the day, you'll have 40 centimeter waves, white caps.
Yeah.
And as I think it was Trev, the caller before, mentioned Lake Alexandrina.
Well, I've been on that in the speedboat, and I can tell you, it can get pretty rough.
Yeah, I've been across that. The last time we went across it, it got really bad with good 2 meter waves. Quite nasty.
Yeah.
So it can get rough, but most of the time, it's a friendly river. And if you're wise, you just wait out those bad times.
Mm.
Wait for the weather to improve.
How do you think about it, Warren? Do you think of it like that in those terms, as a friendly river or as a river? I mean, because this particularly given its, you know, its history of dispossession from Indigenous people's point of view, it's also a place of great of sadness and disappointment too, isn't it?
Yes, I when I see speedboats roaring up and down the river, and they've got a right to use the river too, so don't get me wrong, but I look a bit upon it sometimes and I think to myself, oh, what are they doing to my river, the river that I remember as a child? Yeah. And then I'm reminded of how the Aboriginal people must have felt. I mean, I think the paddle steamers are majestic and gorgeous, but I'm sure the Indigenous people in the 1850s and 60s looked upon these big wooden things belching out smoke and churning up their rivers streaming past, and they probably thought to themselves, what are they doing to our river?
Yes, exactly. And some might say to that today, for Peter, in relation to our practices and agricultural practices, as we come to terms with what we can and can't do in this country of ours.
Of course. Sorry, Peter.
So, go on, Peter.
No, I was just saying it is a challenge. But thank God our river system is within our country. We can talk to each other.
We can
solve this one. We've just got to be patient, allow time to listen to people. Yeah,
that's a fair point to make too. All right, it's been terrific to talk with you, and thanks to both of you too, Peter Phillips and Warren Hardiman. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and thanks to everyone. With stories of the mighty Murray.
I was born on the banks of the Murray. Yorta is my mother.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.